Blog Talk Radio.
For listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Thank you for joining us for this episode 13 from the Eastern Files. If you haven't heard these broadcasts or listened in the past, we call it From the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern as it comes to us. The broadcast will usually be only about one half hour. It could go a little bit over that. And we broadcast in the 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time time slot. We may even throw in a music selection or two. The program is not a talk radio format, and we don't take calls during this broadcast. It's reserved only for Eastern stories, histories, news. We continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We hope you like this new addition to the radio show, and will continue to join us every Thursday at 3 p.m. Now, let's pull an Eastern commercial from the Eastern Files.
It's Sunday in Mexico. The sun floods an arena. The historic duel is on. The sun spotlights a diver at Acapulco. Referees a children's game at the pyramids of Teotihuacan. The sun warms a beautiful mermaid in Puerto Rico. And covers the vacation paradise of Miami. Every year, more people choose this one to the sun because Eastern service is as warm as the destination.
Fly Eastern, number one to the sun.
We have two great stories that were taken from the repartee magazines, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association magazines. The first one was written by Captain Bill Malone, and it's titled Eastern's Love Affair with Lockheed. And the story starts ever since its inception in the rear of a State Street garage in Santa Barbara, California. Lockheed has been ahead of the times with its manufacture of aircraft. As with Lockheed, so was Eastern ahead of its time. As late as the outbreak of World War II, there were no military planes that could keep up with the Lockheed Model 10, known as the Electra. The airmail pilots on Pitcairn Aviation pioneered the new capability of blind flying using the new Sperry Artificial Horizon. The Lockheed Vega had the speed and range to take it all over the world, setting records unheard of at the time. Eastern Airlines was first to go off the air, mail subsidy, and become profitable on its own. Lockheed P-38, known as the Lightning, was one of the most potent fighter aircraft in World War II. Eastern's Doug Davis won the Thompson Trophy in his Travel Air Mystery ship in 1934. The Lockheed Constellation revolutionized air travel, making it as easy to fly from New York to Miami as taking the train from New York to Atlantic City. Eastern's president, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, persuaded the hotels on Miami Beach to stay open year-round and fill them during off-season with passengers flown in from New York. Lockheed built the L-188 prop jet during off-season with passengers flown in. They built this Electra that was the perfect transition airliner to the turbojet. Eastern Airlines created a training facility second to none and one that was utilized by airlines all over the world, using the airline pilots as instructors was a new innovation, which kept the managers of flying abreast of the problems out there on the line. Eastern had the reputation of being a pilot-oriented airline. There was distinctive cooperation between different departments as a result of the admiration that was started among them. This quality had to exist in Lockheed because the company built such fine aircraft. Flying the Lockheed L-1011 was the greatest thrill of all. As little kids, we were caught up in the excitement of the exploits of Wiley Post and Harold Gaddy of the Lockheed Vega, named the Winnie Mae. Wiley Post could be seen on Pathé News at the morning picture show as he climbed out of the cockpit after his around-the-world flight, the black patch over his eye, the wind blowing his hair. The pilot usually made his egress from an overhead hatch just behind the windshield, then climbed down the side of the fuselage. It would seem much easier to come back through the cabin and out the door, but it would not have been nearly so glamorous. But then, back in the days of long-distance record setting, the cabin was usually filled with extra fuel tanks, and you couldn't get through. Amelia Earhart often cast a magic spell as she made her exit from her own Lockheed Vega. In 1928, Lockheed moved to Burbank and built Harry Tucker's gleaming white Vega, trimmed with red and blue Thune stripes, and equipped with the nine-cylinder 425-horsepower Wasp engine made by Pratt & Whitney, the first plane built in the new plant and one destined to make the Lockheed name synonymous with speed. Captain Frank Hawks soon broke its transcontinental speed record in Lockheed's new parasol wing. Air Express model speed and distance records were being set all over the world by such notable aviators as Wilkins and Ellison, Post and Gaddy, Roscoe Turner, Amelia Earhart, Jimmy Doolittle, Howard Hughes, Doug Davis, and the Lindberghs, to mention a few. From 1928 to 1935, you could hardly pick up a newspaper without reading about these adventures and their thrilling flights. The Lockheed Vega became so popular as a transport aircraft in 1929 when Roscoe Turner organized Nevada Airlines to fly between Los Angeles, Reno, and Las Vegas, and streamlined his Vegas with wheel pants. Movie stars and box office luminaries such as Clark Gable, Loretta Young, Fred McMurray, and Joan Bennett often made the trip in the fourth-place Lockheed Vega. In the little town of Patterson, Louisiana, just west of New Orleans, millionaire lumberman Harry Williams and aircraft design genius Jimmy Waddell came together to form Waddell Williams Air Service, beginning with flights from New Orleans to Shreveport, flying Lockheed Vegas, and later extending to Dallas and Fort Worth. Even without a mail contract during the Depression, Waddell Williams Vegas flew their fast schedules between New Orleans and Texas for several years. Later, they secured mail contracts as a result of powerful political connections. Waddell Williams became even more famous as makers of racing planes of superb craftsmanship. Roscoe Turner was one of the pilots to fly these famous racers, along with stunt pilot Joe Mackey, who later founded Mackey Airlines. Mackey Airlines eventually merged with Eastern. Eastern's Doug Davis, who won the Thompson Trophy in 1929, was the only pilot to die in one of the racers. After the death of both partners and successive flying accidents, Waddell Williams was purchased and liquidated in 1936 by Eastern Air Transport. And captains Doug Worthen, Leo Clooney, Mel Sater, and Hank Freeze came on the scene as Eastern pilots. Hank Freeze later became a dispatcher with Eastern Airlines. Our own Art Furchgott, who came to work for Eastern Air Transport in 1932, was based in Houston and worked for the Vegas during the brief time they were operated by Eastern. The acquisition of Waddell Williams by Captain Eddie Rickenbacker gave Eastern Airlines its first penetration into Texas and the beginning of the love affair of its pilots with Lockheed. Lockheed engineers revolutionized the aviation industry with their next leap forward in aircraft design. The Lockheed 10 was an airplane whose best power setting also produced its most economical cruise speed. At nearly full speed, the airplane had its longest range. Other aircraft of the period required a low power setting to extend their range. Lockheed achieved this remarkable characteristic by the unique design of the wing. None of the biplanes in the military could match the Lockheed 10 for speed. For this reason, among others, Amelia Earhart chose it for her around-the-world attempt. Many of us believe she was on a mission for the government to view the Japanese military installations on Saipan prior to our entry into the World War II. The Lockheed 10 was one of the airplanes utilized by Eastern Airlines beginning in 1935 when Eastern was awarded the Atlanta-Chicago mail contract. Warren Jameson, who was hired about that time, recalls that when he flew it for Eastern, the worst weather conditions existed that he can ever remember. The airplane served him well with its line flight characteristics, its fine flight characteristics. It was easy to make a three-point landing with the tail down. It didn't flop over on the main wheels like the twin engines, Beechcraft that came later. Many of the Lockheed 10 airplanes were privately owned. The Vanderbilts owned the one Eastern's Dick Merrill and Jack Lambie used to make precedent-setting around the trip transatlantic flight in 1937. After World War II, child movie star Margaret O'Brien owned one that has since been restored and is located at the municipal airport in Denton, Texas. The next giant step in aviation came with the advent of the Lockheed Constellation, which brought with it high altitude, pressurized flight, and supercharged engines. Not only did it utilize two-stage superchargers, it incorporated the power recovery turbine, the PRT, which consisted of a small fan driven by exhaust gases. It is in most new cars now under the name of turbopower. John Halliburton, vice president of flight operations, sent a group of Eastern pilots to the Lockheed Constellation School at the factory in Burbank. The training included the flight engineer's course and lasted 6 weeks. They had to learn every circuit breaker in the electrical system. Captain Rickenbacker wanted them to be sure they knew the airplane because there had been a recent training accident attributed to smoke in the cockpit. The cockpit window had been opened and smoke was sucked in from the cabin. A method devised to open an overwing cabin window first and then open a cockpit window on the opposite side This blew the smoke out of the airplane, leaving the cockpit clear. Believing in the Peter principle, which says that if something can go wrong, it will, our pilots pressed to have a crossfeed valve installed in the hydraulic system so that hydraulic pressure would be available if numbers 3 and 4 engines were lost. These pumps supply the system for raising the and lowering the landing gear. It was thought that a broken line would more likely occur than the loss of those two engines. Later, this was disproved when a Super Constellation was unable to make it from Seattle into McCord because the gear could not be raised, having lost engines 3 and 4 on takeoff. Eastern enjoyed great success with its Lockheed Constellations. They were immediate favorites of pilots such as Warren Jamison and Paul Charles. Tex Maxwell written Eddie's admonition when pilots referred to it as a Connie. He said it was like calling your wife an old bag. Passengers poured into the Miami Beach luxury hotels flown from New York on the nonstop Constellation night coaches with their economical fares. Time-wise, it was not much different from riding the train to Atlantic City. The next acquisition for Eastern was a Lockheed PropJet Electra that took us to higher altitudes and faster flight. For many, this became a favorite because of its positive control and superb performance. It brought forth a whole new nomenclature. Throttles became power levers because of the many functions they performed. Control was so positive, one had to be careful not to over-control the aircraft. The engines provided more power than we had ever seen. Flights were smoother at the higher altitudes. We began to develop a more delicate touch. It took a long time for the engines to spin down, so procedures were introduced to keep from having to wait to open the door and deplane the aircraft. We learned to pump the air conditioner down so as not to slug the compressor when it was turned back on. Advanced pressurization and ground cooling was introduced. It was a perfect transition airplane for things to come. Come they did, in the form of the magnificent Lockheed L-1011. Names were changed again as switches became switch lights. Sitting in the cockpit so far off the ground, we all wondered how in the world we could learn to flare for landing this big aircraft. The Lockheed designers, in their infinite wisdom, knew that aviators had to have a sense of feel to fly the big plane, so they designed artificial feel into it. There was no way that such large control surfaces in such an enormous aircraft could be manipulated by connecting cables, even with conventional boost. They had to be driven by direct hydraulic drives. But then when the pilot operated the controls, he was only opening a valve. The matter was solved by simply installing springs on the cockpit controls, which it would extend at high speeds, and taking the slop out of the controls just as the controls become more rigid in a speedboat when it increases speed. With the help of the marvelous flight simulators in Eastern's training department, we mastered the ability to flare. The redundancy built into the electrical, hydraulic, air conditioning, and power systems inspired confidence. The sophisticated autopilot and the fantastic Omega navigation system made the Lockheed 1011 a dream to fly. The Rolls-Royce engines were so big they took a long time to start, so our pilots soon devised a way of speeding things up. A glance in the maintenance log would reveal which engines had the least amount of time on it and would be the easiest to start. This would be the one to start first, using the lesser air supply from the auxiliary power unit. Once it was up to speed and supplying the stronger air supply, the remaining two engines could be started simultaneously and much faster. Usually the captain and co-pilot would have a race to see who could start his engine first. It was not unusual for an audience of ground personnel from other airlines to show up for this demonstration of efficiency. The standardization program developed by Eastern over a number of years made it possible for a crew of three perfect strangers to come together and conduct the flight without a pre-flight briefing, because everyone knew what to do and what was expected of them. At the same time, it was not so restrictive as to keep one from displaying his individual style. Cockpit discipline became fun because it made the operation so much easier, and Eastern was authorized to operate in weather conditions formerly unimaginable. Tower personnel at the Seattle-Tacoma Airport would do a double take when Eastern's Lockheed L-1011 approached the north runway in a hard side slip when the wind was strong out of the west. They couldn't believe such a large airplane could be flown in such a conventional manner. It was all due to the expertise of the Lockheed designers in being able to grasp the problems facing the pilot. This concept was confined to the cockpit. The Eastern Airlines flight attendants had been consulted for their suggestions in the design of the cabin, and as a result, the in-flight service was superb. The ovens, beverages, serving carts, and in-flight service gear were all located on a floor below the passenger cabin, and everything was brought up on elevators. More aisle space for the flight attendants to perform their duties. Even today, we remember as we raise the glasses we bought when the Eastern inventory was auctioned. The Lockheed 1011, or Whisper Liner as we called it, also became a favorite of the passengers because of its huge size, luxurious appointments, and smooth flying. They must have known how much we enjoyed flying it from up front. Truly, it was a love affair, the Eastern Airline pilots with Lockheed, because of its exceptional design aircraft. Well, that's the story of the L-1011, the Constellation, Lockheed Super Constellations, and the Vegas, and the Lockheed Electra that Amelia Earhart flew. Now, for a little humor, another story written by Hank Foley, another editor of the REPA magazine, and this one is called Some Old-Time Repartee. I think you'll enjoy this. Humor is as important an attribute of the human race and has existed all through the ages. Biblical scholars believe that even Adam and Eve had their little jokes. When Eve would hear a noise outside the door, she would ask, "Is that you, Adam?" And he would answer with a chuckle, "Now really, Eve, who were you expecting?" When archaeologists dug among the ruins of ancient Pompeii buried by the eruptions of Mount Vesuvius 2,000 years ago, they found tablets with the inscription, "Quid erat illa domina vidi tecum, ultima non erat domina, illa erat mea luxor." All of you who struggle through Latin in school can readily translate this. It was, "Who was that lady I saw you with last night?" "That was no lady, that was my wife." In the long history of Eastern Airlines, humor playing an interesting, albeit minor, background part. Those hundreds of situations, occurrence, reactions, and remarks that we enjoy hearing about, I realize that some of these stories have been retold 1,000 times over the years, so that in repeating them, I'm breaking the cardinal rule of not telling a story to people who have already heard it. But my purpose is not to provide a belly laugh, but rather to arouse a twinge of nostalgia. As we get older, most of us prefer low-key humor. Or, as Hiawatha might have said, sort of mini-ha-ha. In my early days with Eastern, I heard several times a story about one of our historic senior captains, Charlie Myers. No funny stories could ever diminish Captain Myers' reputation in the world of aviation for having designed the famous Great Lakes and the Waco 10. As I heard it, Charlie was a survivor of the original Seat of the Pants fraternity who wasn't too thrilled by some of the new gadgets in the aircraft. Flying one of the early DC-3s, he was assigned a co-pilot who was super conscientious, a guy who couldn't sit still but must be continually adjusting the mixture, synchronizing the props, checking the cowl flaps, fussing about temperatures, pressures, voltages, and so forth. Eventually, he overleaned one of the mixtures and the engine quit. Charlie turned to him and said, "All right, you gadget-pulling, button-pushing son of a bee. What are you going to do now?" Undoubtedly, a dozen readers will snort, "No, that's not the way it was," and proceed to give a different version. But the co-pilot in question has passed on, so we'll never know. Captain O.B. Bivens, told about a flight with Charlie Myers. During a fairly high-speed descent, Charlie called for gear down. O.B. mentioned that they were quite a bit above maximum gear down speed. Charlie's response was, "If your damn landings didn't knock the gear off that aircraft, then what, the wind is not going to blow it off?" As a co-pilot in New York, I often came in contact with Captain Ed Harrington. Ed is one of those people known as a born comedian. By tone of voice, facial expression, and gesture, he could make a simple matter-of-fact statement sound funny. Many people claimed he resembled a cartoon character in the comic strip called Major Hoople, and he got the nickname. When Eastern acquired the DC-4, Ed was a check pilot, and during a training session, there was an extra pilot in the passenger cabin just along for the ride. At one point, the captain, being checked out, got up from the seat for a break, and Ed invited the other pilot in the back to come up and get the feel of our first four-engine aircraft. The fellow climbed in the seat and tried some turns and some climbs and remarked about the fine performance. What he didn't know was that one of the inboard engines was feathered. After a few more raves about the airplane, Ed turned to the fellow and said, "Yeah, it's terrific, and you ought to see it on four engines." Aside from his humor, Ed was considered to be one awfully good pilot by everyone who flew with him. During the war years, I had occasion to fly with him in the Colesman Lockheed, and I observed some performance that I've never seen duplicated since then. Old-timers of the New York base will remember a very popular pilot, C.I. Snuffy Smith, as he was called, his nickname, Snuffy. He had as keen a mind as you'll never find, but his stature was diminutive and his facial expression conveyed an air of innocent bewilderment, somewhat on the order of Woody Allen. Snuffy was taking an instrument check from Fred Davis. I don't have to describe Fred Davis to any Eastern pilot. His reputation has spread far and wide. He was the epitome of all good pilots, a true perfectionist. When you flew with Fred, you did it right, period, and that was that. I recall being given an oral by Fred, and he asked if I could trace the fuel system from tank to engine. I answered, "I think so." And he said, "Do you think or do you know?" To get back to Snuffy Smith's check on a DC-3, they passed the old range station in Brooklyn on approach to runway 4 at LaGuardia. Snuffy gave the common old signal for gear down by gesturing thumb down. Fred ignored the gesture because you were supposed to call out loud and clear, "Gear down!" Snuffy gestured again. Fred ignored it again. Time was running out, and Snuffy nervously gestured a third time. This time, Fred retorted, What did you say? Snuffy, now desperate, turned his big eyes and baby face to Fred and said, please. Some of my happiest times as co-pilot were spent with Captain Mel Sater. He was that wonderful combination of fine pilot and perfect gentleman. But along with that, many of us can recall the twinkle in his eye that bespoke a sharp but restrained sense of humor. At the time when the government agencies were attempting to get everyone to change to the metric system, I recall Mel remarking, we've been living with feet, yards, rods, furlongs, fathoms, knots, cable lengths, pints, quarts, fists, petite, small, regular, extra large, jumbo, and they ask if we'll be confused by the metric system? Whenever a group of pilots gathered, there was bound to be some lively humor. A favorite subject was married life. The thing I noticed was that the happily married, well-adjusted fellows were most likely to tell the stories. Those who were not happy with their marriage probably didn't feel like joking about it. Obviously, it would not be in good taste to identify the individuals who told these jokes about their home life. But here's a sample of some of their comments. When we were first married, we got along okay, but then as we were leaving the church, the after-dinner drink at our house is Alka-Seltzer. She's beautiful, lively, loves airplanes, good sense of humor, but I often feel like packing a lunch to go home. Every morning at breakfast, she sets off the smoke alarm. At least she cured the dog of begging at the table. Company champion golfers told of a couple who completed a game and were having a 19th hole drink. After the exercise and the drink, the wife became pensive and mused to her husband. If I were to die, would you marry again? Not too much interested in such a discussion, he answered, oh, I suppose so. She continued, would you give her my jewelry? Oh, probably. And my furs? I guess so. You wouldn't give her my golf clubs? Oh, no, she's left-handed. Naturally, when men are telling the stories, the husband always has the clever lines. But if one listens in on a pilot's wives' club meeting, he'd hear the other point of view. And it goes like this. She told him to take the garbage out to the Bermuda Triangle. Wake up, dear. It's 5 o'clock. The coffee is ready. It's on the shelf in the kitchen cabinet. The house was on fire and the wife was getting the children out the door when one of them started screaming. The mother says, shh, be quiet. You'll wake up daddy. Speaking about the females in the Eastern family brings to mind something Joe Mullen told me as I checked in for one of those ungodly early morning trips. He was chuckling about a new stewardess who came to the crew sked window, still sleepy-eyed. She told Joe, you know, I never realized before that 4:30 came around twice a day. Over the years, whenever I met Joe Myers around the system, he'd pause and exchange a joke or two. I believe it all started when he flew his first officer with me and always made better landings than I did. And he'd tell me a funny story to cheer me up. One of his stories I still recall was about a pilot's wife who heard repeated rumors that her husband was spending a lot of time with a stewardess at the other end of the line. When she confronted him, he admitted it and then added impulsively that the captain who lived down the street also had a girlfriend. Later, when the husband and wife were riding a pass on vacation, the unthinkable happened. The stewardess in question was working the trip up front in the first class section. The wife recognized the name, and the husband confirmed that she was the girl, and he added, right next to her is a girl that Captain so-and-so down the street is involved with. The wife observed them both for several minutes, then calmly stated to her husband, I like ours better. I'll finish up with another remark by Joe Myers. One time, he shocked me by telling me he was a Marxist, a great admirer of Marx. Then, after enjoying the puzzled look on my face, he added, "Groucho, that is." Joe knew the value of a good joke. And that is the stories. They are the stories from the Eastern File today, and we hope you enjoy them. So with that, we'll say have a nice day as Hurricane Matthews bears down on Northeast Florida. Everyone in the state of Florida will be safe and dry and with minimum damages. Everyone is in our prayers. We hope you enjoyed these great Eastern stories selected from the Eastern Files for today's broadcast. If you would like to contribute a story from your Eastern days and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story so that it goes on from the Eastern Files. Send it to host@theEALradioshow.com. That's host@theEALradioshow.com. We want you to be part of the radio show. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. The time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to stay. And smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go.
hate to go.